This MP3 file runs 32 minutes. Claudine will talk about her early and current environmental work, why she ran for Congress, and how she was pretty much at home within the 1980s Republican Party on Capitol Hill, even while functioning as an independent-minded coalition builder. Some of our more finely grained discussion is being saved for the book, which means it's not here in the audio. But one of her New England colleagues, because he's mentioned in a memorable way here in the audio, requires a preview. That would be the late Silvio Conti, GOP congressman from Massachusetts, who served from 1959 all the way through 1992.
I noticed there was a 5-6 year stretch here with something called the Conservation Law Foundation, which is seems like a pretty heavy-duty base for somebody who's only 26, 27. What was that, and what was your role in it?
Well, when I was about, and this is about, I don't pay attention to my age because I have no idea how old I am, and I don't really care, but I was... I had learned they wanted to build a nuclear power plant down the way from us. So I was part of a group that organized folks in opposition to it. And it was pretty astonishing because there was a major federal law being broken and there was not a lawyer that was willing to represent us. And the opposition to the nuclear plant came from a sense of justice and democracy. Because I had moved to New England. I was from Pittsburgh originally, and I thought they held town meetings here. I thought that people's opinion made a difference. I don't understand how this is happening without the knowledge of the citizens. And so looked all over the state for a lawyer to represent the people. And we could not find a lawyer that wasn't already engaged with the utility, with the state government, with the local government.
Were you looking for a pro bono, or were you willing to pay?
Well, we were just looking for a lawyer that ate nails for breakfast and glass for lunch. Yeah. That's all, because we were very determined
that SOB.
We were right. And, you know, so at any rate, I did find a lawyer from Chicago. I took a course in a paralegal course so that he could tell me what to do, and we filed an injunction and other such things. But at the end of that exhausting time period, I thought, Rhode Island needs a law firm that represents the people. Mm-hmm. And against such things as the toxic waste dumps, the polluted waterways, etc. So, I learned that there was an environmental law firm in New England called the Conservation Law Foundation of New England. And so the Rhode Island Conservation Law Foundation was fashioned after that.
I see. Good.
So I became the first executive director. I organized it, and I found lawyers who were willing to do pro bono work. And I would assess the cases that came to us and determine whether we should take it on or not.
You were also in journalism sort of parallel to this, or on and off?
Never been in journalism.
Okay, those TV productions you did in the early 70s, or in the late
70s? Amateur.
Really?
Most of my life I have had on-the-job training. I was a language major in college. I studied French, Spanish, and when I got out, I studied Chinese, because I knew the future was China. And they were not teaching Chinese in colleges at that time, so I went to American University Night School to study Chinese. So when I ran for Congress the first time in 78 and lost, I sat there and I thought, you know, people know my name. I've got the name recognition, but they don't know what I stand for. And so I rationalized that the best medium to communicate that would be television. And I thought, maybe I'll see if I could do a public affairs show. So just as I had gotten my request together and my self-confidence and was about to pick up the phone to dial it, the phone rang. And it was the NBC affiliate saying, would you be interested in a public affairs show? So that's
you had no friends over there? This was just a magical synchronicity Carl Jung moment?
Story of my life.
Wow. 78, that campaign, did you think you might win? Was the 48% a surprise that you did that well?
I never would think that I would win or lose. I would always think I will do the best job I possibly can.
Okay.
So that regardless of the outcome, I will be able to stand with my head held and have no regrets that, oh, I forgot to do this or I should have done this, because much of my life, that has been a driving force for me to try to live my life with no regrets. It may be useful to know why I ran for Congress in the first place. When I was 25, I was diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease. The doctors told me that I had a 50-50 chance of survival. And at that moment, I immediately focused on what is my purpose here, because I had always believed that every human being is on this earth for a purpose. And at 25, I thought, well, I was a good daughter, sister, student, but what have I really done on this earth? What purpose have I fulfilled? And I was pretty, uncertain. I really hadn't fulfilled any purpose. So I became very purpose-driven. And since there was an enormous amount of synchronicity, and since I was very aware and attentive, when my husband was first thinking of running for office, and he said, no, I'm not going to do it, but I think you should. So he was the one that pushed me, and I laughed it off, and I said, you got to be kidding. You know, I'm not interested in this. And
how old were you when you got married?
25. A lot happened when I was 25. Okay. It all happened, you know. Yep. Found out I was diagnosed, then I got married, and then, you know, started taking on justice and citizen representation and my belief in democracy. When I then had two other people out of nowhere come to me and say, you should run, it's like, okay, third time's the charm, but you've got to be kidding me, you know, this is not what I expected to do with my life. But I thought, you know, we have a terrible situation here in Rhode Island and in the country. I think that people have an inability to connect the dots, meaning in the state what was pretty dominant was that people were dumping their toxic waste into Narragansett Bay. They would close the bay to shellfishing. The shell fishermen would suffer, be out of work, be out of food. I mean, it was pretty intense. And then people would eat the fish. Some people would fish illegally. And then they would, you know, get cancer. Rhode Island had the third highest death rate of cancer in the United States at the time. And my husband was the director of the research lab on ocean pollution. And he would show us these fish that had, you know, boils, disgusting things. So I thought, well, that's bad news. The other bad news is the incumbent has no sense of discretion when he's voting on the budget, because he seems to vote for everything. And needless to say, these are our tax dollars, and we need to be more conscientious about picking and choosing how we spend money in the federal government. And so those were two of the dynamics that motivated me to run. Wasteful spending and you know, a lack of understanding of the connection between environment and health.
And the foundation, going back a few years before that, was this need to make a difference, have a purpose, carry out a purpose.
Yeah. So I thought maybe my purpose is just to articulate the messages, to have a soapbox, to let people know we need to be more thoughtful about these things. And so I thought I will do the best job I possibly can in articulating these messages and in campaigning and working. We had no money, no name recognition, and no experience. So,
well, after that TV show in 79, 80, you did have better name recognition.
Absolutely. Yeah. But I'm talking about the first time I ran, I had nothing. Did the TV show, then, you know, many people knew who I was and what I stood for. They all knew my name, but they didn't know what I stood for. So the shows that I did, I would bring in the CEO of Brown and Sharp, a tool manufacturing company, and then bring in the head of the labor union. And I had always wanted, I was planning on going into the Foreign Service to be a diplomat. So I thought, well, I will help bring these two voices together and play diplomat on screen and better understand where each are coming from. Walk in their shoes. Because in Rhode Island, there were Native Americans who always used to talk about how the white people didn't understand them because we've never walked in their shoes. And I am interested in understanding all people.
That Foreign Service aspiration, does that go back to college days?
It goes back to being a young child whose father was in the Army and whose mother was in the Belgian underground, saving American soldiers, hiding Jews, and losing two of her brothers in the process. So there was always that sadness around war. And as a young girl, I would ask myself, why do we have war? I mean, at very young, I was asking that because I saw the pain of my father and his army buddies getting together and talking about a buddy who had been killed. And you could tell they were sad. As a little girl, I could feel this. I didn't have to hear the words. And it became real clear to me I was going to figure that out. And so I thought, well, if two people sit together, look at eyeball to eyeball, then we can build understanding and build bridges of cooperation. So that was my intention, to help prevent war by learning different languages and by being part of the Foreign Service.
In a nutshell, why do we have war? There's more than lack of communication, but that's part of it. But
it's lack of understanding.
Lack of understanding.
Yes. And a commitment to understand. I have been to 53 different countries. I have walked in many different shoes. And it is so sad to see that there is this resistance, particularly on Americans' part over the last several years, to put an emphasis on diplomacy, to put an emphasis on communication and understanding and cooperation. So
aren't we going to test that theory now with Obama?
Well, some of the wars that we have that are emerging are resource wars.
Right.
Some of the wars that we had in the last couple of years have to do with resources, like oil.
And water.
Yep. And now,
but aren't we going to test the idea that diplomacy can work without military force? I mean, isn't that what we're...
Well, I don't think it will be tested without military force. They are two halves of a whole.
I see.
But the one half had been decimated over the last several years. Now, hopefully, it will be restored to equal parts.
Thinking local bread and butter here,
yeah.
Obviously I understand why you're on Merchant Marine and Fisheries. Porter Goss explained to me how vital that was in Southwest Florida.
Yeah.
What kind of a base was that for you? How did you use that membership on that committee?
Well, it was a very good base in that this was the 80s. Our awareness of our impact on the environment had just started a decade earlier. Environmental laws had just started, you know, in the 1970s. When I formed the environmental law firm of the Conservation Law Foundation, these were guys mostly just out of, you know, law school who were just beginning to understand, Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act. So I used it as an opportunity for my constituents to say that, look, the striped bass are being overfished. We need a moratorium. And so I took a lot of heat on that also, an enormous amount of heat. Of course, Sports Illustrated wrote it up, and then I took national heat for it. First time I was ever in Sports Illustrated, but, you know, it became national news, a striped bass moratorium. But in the end, they said, thank you. You know, we did the right thing.
In the end, years later?
Years later. Then the other thing is that I knew pollution was horrible because, as I said, my husband was the director of the research laboratory on ocean pollution. And I connected the dots that if we eat these fish, we get sick. Well, I had already had cancer, so I wanted to prevent others and to understand if we pollute our air, if we pollute our waters, we are the ones that suffer in the end. So I used it once again as a soapbox to educate. That we lived in a closed system. I also used that position to move some national legislation, and I remember working bipartisanly with Barbara Boxer on the Ocean Dumping Ban Act and the Dolphin Free dolphin-free tuna. And Don Young was on the committee, always enthused about, you know, being the thorn in the side. And
still is.
I remember that I was very frustrated in getting support. So I got my husband to give me some of the samples from the lab that had the warts and the boils on the fish, put them in baggies, passed them around to each of the members on the committee, and said, guys, you, your family, your children are eating these. You're getting sick, and you will die. It's in your face. Explanation, what can I say? But sometimes it takes a while for people who are hooked on ideology, who are always opposed to everything that relates to the environment, to let them know the connection between it and them.
What, did you get along with Sol Conti?
Very well. Very well. He was a real character.
Yeah.
Yes.
You got a story about him? He's the guy I would most like to interview. He's gone now. I've heard so many things about him.
Well, he was, you know, what I had envisioned as a politician. And I made the distinction between public servant and politicians oftentimes. But, you know, he was a backslapping, fare-thee-well, good old boy who, I think, felt uncomfortable with women in his, you know, universe of legislating. But he was also like a good-hearted, fatherly type that, you know, would say, well, honey, this is the way you want to look at it. Or so, but he was a love. He was really delightful. Yeah.
Bob Michael was our leader the whole time you were there. Do you think it was fair? Could you get a good decision from him when you wanted to?
Oh, yeah. He was a very good man. Good-hearted, good leader, honest, respected. And he wanted to keep Republicans, so he would say, do what you need to do. He said, you know, we would like you all to follow us, but if you can't, do what you need to do.
Jack Kemp sometimes called himself a bleeding heart conservative, and he made a lot of outreaches to blacks and minorities and other things.
Right. Well, his constituency, you know, he would not have gotten elected were it not for a broader support than the white male. But
it wasn't a calculation of his benefit. I mean, everybody I've ever worked with, I've known a lot of Kemp's best friends over the years, they say he really cared.
Yeah.
I mean, did you have that sense? Or
Jack Kemp?
Yeah.
Yes. I liked him a lot. And he was one of the more thoughtful members of Congress. I remember when I first got there, he seemed to be on the floor pretty regularly doing his oratory on, you know, either the gold standard, which I knew nothing about, and I was fascinated to sit and learn what he had to say, or he would be talking about, you know, enterprise zones.
Yeah.
And I thought, great concept, that is a cool... So he was original thinker, problem solver, which, you know, what I had aspired to.
You didn't see him as ideological.
You know, I was there about getting the job done, about making a difference. And at that time, ideology was nowhere near where it is today in the party. It was, I think, many good-hearted people trying to do what was in the best interest of the nation. There was a Republican Party that was inclusive, the Big Tent, that, you know, Jack Kemp and Newt Gingrich talked about and worked for and seemed committed to. And then in the 90s, Dick Armey, Tom DeLay, you know, that went away. And year after year after year, the Republican Party has, you know, gotten more lockstep than in the 80s when I was there.
Although it worked for a while, from 94 to 2006, we had the majority, even though we were losing liberals.
Yeah.
So,
well, that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about, you know, winning the majority. We're talking about being an inclusive party.
I see. Whether you're 100 or 200,
those
are different scales. Yeah.
But, you know, if you're excluding people who were, you know, followers of Abraham Lincoln and Teddy Roosevelt and Rockefeller and Javits. It's like, okay, well,
maybe they just lost the debates and decided to go elsewhere. I mean, do you think they were consciously pushed out?
Ask Jim Jeffords.
I think he switched at an opportunistic time.
Well, some people can take the heat. Others decide it's easier to move.
Yeah, and I think the majority coalition that doesn't keep the minority happy will lose people and eventually suffer. I agree with that. But, I mean, it's not like, okay, three of us say one thing, you say the opposite. Are we supposed to, are one of us three supposed to change so we're 2-2? I mean, people and advocate what they want.
It's just the forcefulness, the tactics that I have heard of. I did not witness because I was in Congress during a kinder, gentler time, to quote George Bush Sr.
Right.
And Ronald Reagan. There was cooperation, collaboration, admiration. Mm-hmm. And I believe that when the Republicans, you know, started getting their majorities or whatever, it was because they tightened ranks and marched lockstep, and they said to Jim Jeffords, you're not getting the chairmanship, and the president's not going to go to, you know, your state, even though, or invite you here, and John Chafee, we're not going to allow you to do this and that.
Should you vote against your party 80% of the time and get a chairmanship? I mean, is there no... If you're on the team and getting a senior
position. Well, it depends.
Position.
I think that you ought to state the rules of the game first. If that's the criteria, then make it known.
Okay. All right. That's fair.
Don't you think that if we had a kinder, gentler Republican Party, as we did in the days of Reagan and George Bush Sr.?
Newt was not kinder, gentler when he destroyed Jim Wright. You need a mix. You need the iron fist and the velvet glove.
Maybe so, but I think that this is a time of enormous hatred coming out of the mouths of Republicans, such as, who's the radio guy that I like to try to forget?
Obviously Rush.
Yeah. I mean, to have an R after my name and have him have an R after.
But are you an independent now, or?
I am a Republican.
Still. I know it's hard sometimes. I mean, I sympathize.
It's embarrassing.
Tom Davis, the former NRCC chairman, says there's going to be a sweep, and he says in New England, Republicans, including moderates, are going to come back this year. He made this emphatic statement in the Washington Times. He's working with the Main Street group, which is, I guess, a current equivalent of the Wednesday group.
Well,
do you keep in touch with many of your old colleagues?
Not really.
I mean, you run into them now and then.
Yeah. You know, the ones that I happen to have been friends with, like Tom Ridge, got very busy. And Olympia Snow was another buddy of mine, is a buddy of mine, and is still incredibly busy. Steve Gunderson from Wisconsin, he's now the head of the Foundation Association, and called him once and we tried to meet, but then my schedule got crazy, so we didn't connect.
What do you think about cap and trade?
This was an idea that the business community feels was appropriate. Initially, I was against it because it's an excuse to buy more time.
Yeah.
We don't have time. If you've walked in my shoes. If you've been to some of the countries that I've been to and you see what's already happening, and it's no joke about the Maldives going underwater. They're Muslims. Do you think the Indians want them to move in? Do people even know what religion the Indians practice for the most part? I don't think so. Now, you talk about conflict over resources. I was in a meeting with a woman from Uganda recently. Her whole village was wiped away because of sea level rise. Her home, her business, everything gone. They have 29 people living in one house right now, and they know that the United States is responsible for this. What is that doing to our national security?
Who's responsible for what?
Climate change.
Not China, not India. We're responsible for climate change?
Oh, my God, Frank. We are the most industrialized nation in the world. India and China are catching up. But China has figured out where the beef is. That's why they are building wind generation systems, energy efficiency, insulation. The companies that I work with are freaking out because they are taking our technology, leveraging it, making it cheaper, ASAP. And we're going to end up buying our solar systems from the Chinese. You look in the stock market, SunTech is one of the most successful solar companies. I formed the Solar Alliance a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I was gonna...
30 of the world's largest solar companies. I said, guys, you want market share? You have to speak with one voice. Nobody's hearing you. You know, you're a little here, a little... So I said, what do you need? You need these four policies? You need net metering? You need interconnection? Well, then make it clear and move on. Well, there were only two American solar companies. The rest are Japanese and German, and the one that was coming on the strongest is the Chinese. So when Obama says, wake up, America, if we don't get these technologies as our own, we are going to be continuing to buy them. I was on the Science and Research and Technology Committee. Mm-hmm. We were ready to roll with wind and solar, but the budgets kept getting cut and put into coal and oil depletion allowances and nuclear power to finance the Price-Anderson Act.
Obama's very pro-nuclear power as a solution to greenhouse gases.
He is not very pro. He said that this was a concession to get cap and trade.
Okay, so you think if cap and trade collapses in the Senate, the administration will stop supporting
nuclear plants? How come people can't connect the dots that the flooding that's happening in the Midwest, the tornado that happened in Oklahoma, the extreme snow in Washington, D.C., that infuriates me. To say, oh, well, obviously there's not global warming. What kind of stupid joke is that?
If this is as much snow as we had 10, 15 years ago when I came here.
Well, the bottom line is that the scientists told us on the Science and Tech Committee, you will have extreme weather patterns that are erratic. Extreme and erratic, two operable words.
Okay.
That you will have sea level rise. Do you happen to know that New York City has a sea level rise plan? That they have stopped two large, high rises from being built along the Hudson? I mean, the cities and the states take this seriously. It's just that the people in the bubble here don't get.
Why did Copenhagen
fail? Oh, for a variety of reasons, but, you know.
Okay, send me an email on that.
Because,
I mean, you'd blame in us. It seems to me Obama was willing to do things that I personally don't like, but he couldn't get China, Russia, Brazil, and Russia to go along.
Let's be real. When America speaks, whether it's through a celebrity, through anybody, the rest of the world pays attention.
We have a celebrity president. They didn't listen to him in Copenhagen.
No, but that's because what you need to do is follow up your action, your words with your actions. And he knew that he doesn't have a Senate that would support a treaty. He's no dummy. But the fact of the matter is, we are the greatest consumers on earth. We don't seem to care. And those are the only two messages that are coming across in the rest of the world. India and China want to be like us.
Right. That's pretty powerful.
Well, the reality is they are leapfrogging our years of commitment to fossil fuel, and they're moving into efficiency and renewables big time.
So you're against coal and more nuclear plants even now?
Let me tell you that the first time I fought against the nuclear plant, it was because of justice. My opposition to it now continues to be the justice.
Well, who can argue with justice? But I'm saying, is the technology as destructive now as it was?
It's not a technology. It's like people talking about the science of climate change. Give me a break. The bottom line
is no science.
On nuclear power plant is the cost. If you're a conservative, you would do a least cost analysis of all of the options that the United States has. This is how I defeated the Clinch River Breeder Reactor in committee when the Democrats said, oh, you'll never do it. We've been working on it for 10 years. And I said, it is. Ronald Reagan asked me to reduce waste, fraud, and abuse. The Clinch River Breeder Reactor was initially a partnership with industry and government. And it went over, I can't remember the figure now, I think it was like $8 billion. Yeah.
That was a strange coalition of people that opposed that thing.
This is what I do, build coalitions. But it was built on the economics. And if you look at the economics of nuclear today and the justice issue, what, you think you're going to put a nuke plant in the backyard of a bunch of, you know, somebody in Cincinnati? Good luck with that one.
People want those good high-paying engineering jobs now in ways they didn't 5 years ago.
Well, not when they know that energy efficiency can save as much and provide twice as many jobs and be least cost.
Do you speak informally or do you give prepared texts?
Informally.
Okay, so that you can't send me like policy papers or anything you've done?
No.
Okay.
I used to have people come and, apply for a job as a speechwriter. I said, no. I write all my own speeches. Thank you.